The winter of 1842 arrived at Greystone Court the way it always did, quietly, beautifully, and without mercy. Frost crept across the stone window ledges in thin silver fingers. The gardens, once overflowing with roses and lavender, had been stripped bare by November winds, leaving only skeletal hedges and frozen fountains standing like sentinels against the grey English sky. Inside the great manor, however, warmth blazed from every hearth, and laughter floated through corridors panelled in dark oak and hung with paintings of men long dead, who all shared the same proud Kensington jaw and the same cold, appraising eyes. Greystone Court was one of the finest estates in all of England. Everyone agreed on that. What they also agreed on, though they were more careful about saying it aloud, was that the house's newest resident was quite the loveliest thing to grace its drawing rooms in a generation, and quite the most impossible. Her name was Scarlett Holloway. She sat near the far edge of the drawing room, her needle moving in small, careful strokes through a length of cream silk she was mending for the Dowager Duchess. Around her, the sound of aristocratic England filled every corner of the room. Ladies in gowns of deep burgundy and sage green laughed with the practiced ease of women who had never once worried about their next meal. Gentlemen leaned close, murmuring things designed to be overheard and admired. Crystal teacups caught the firelight. Silver trays passed between gloved hands. Scarlett did not belong to any of it, and she knew it. She was the daughter of Thomas Holloway, who had served as a state steward at Greystone Court for 22 years before his death the previous spring. Her father had been an honourable man, steady and intelligent, the kind of man who kept meticulous ledgers and never once asked for anything beyond his modest wage. He had also, some 12 years ago, pulled the late Duke of Greystone from a collapsed section of the estate's old mill. A moment of courage that had broken two of Thomas Holloway's ribs and very likely saved the Duke's life. The Kensington family did not forget debts. When Thomas Holloway died, the Dowager Duchess Adeline Kensington had offered his daughter a place at Greystone Court as her personal companion. It was an act of generosity, framed with such quiet dignity that Scarlett could not refuse without seeming ungrateful. And she hadn't refused. She had packed her three good dresses, her father's Bible, and a small leather journal into a single trunk, and she had come to live among people who would never quite decide what to make of her. Not a servant. Not a guest. Not a relation. Something uncomfortable in between. Scarlett was 22 years old. She had her mother's dark auburn hair, which she wore pinned back in a style that managed to be elegant without looking as though she had tried. Her eyes were a particular shade of grey-green that changed with the light, darker when she was troubled, almost blue when she laughed. Her face was the sort that made people look twice, then quickly pretend they hadn't. Even the most insufferable of the ladies gathered in that drawing room would have admitted, begrudgingly, and only to themselves, that Scarlett Holloway was beautiful. Being beautiful without a fortune, however, was rather like owning a fine carriage with no horses. It drew attention. It drew nothing useful. She kept her gaze on her needlework, but her eyes moved once, just once, toward the fireplace, where Lord John Kensington stood laughing at something the man beside him had said. Lord John was everything a young woman raised on too little and too much imagination might dream about. He was tall, with the kind of easy, effortless handsomeness that required no particular effort to maintain. His hair was a warm brown that caught copper in the firelight. His smile was generous and frequent, and when it landed on someone, it made them feel, at least briefly, like the most interesting person in the room. He had a gift for conversation that required neither substance nor sincerity. He could speak charmingly about almost nothing for a remarkable length of time, and people came away from the exchange feeling flattered rather than empty. He was also the younger brother of the Duke of Greystone, which made him utterly, completely, devastatingly out of reach for Scarlet Holloway. She knew this. She had always known it. But knowing a thing and feeling it were two very different disciplines, and Scarlet had never been quite disciplined enough when it came to Lord John. As if sensing the pull of her gaze, he looked up from across the room. He smiled at her. It was the kind of smile he gave to everyone. Warm, careless, easy as sunlight. But when it touched Scarlet's face, something in her chest went quiet, and then very loud all at once. She looked down immediately, back to her needlework, her needle going still in her fingers. She did not notice Lady Vivian Stirling watching. Vivian Stirling was 26 years old, possessed of considerable fortune, considerable beauty, and a jealousy so refined it barely showed on her face. She had spent 3 seasons maneuvering herself into Augustus Kensington's orbit, which was no small feat given that the Duke of Greystone moved through society like a cold front, present, impossible to ignore, and not particularly interested in being approached. She had not yet captured his attention in any meaningful way, and she blamed this, with the perfectly arranged logic of someone who could not be wrong, on distractions. Scarlet Holloway was a distraction. Vivian watched John's smile. She watched Scarlet's downcast eyes, and something sharp and certain settled behind her own elegant expression. An hour later, while the Dowager Duchess dozed in her chair near the window, and the afternoon gathering began to shift and disperse, Lady Vivian excused herself from her companions and slipped through the connecting door into the small sitting room beyond the drawing room, where coats and gloves were kept, and where, she had been told, Scarlet often left her things. The journal was there on the side table. Scarlet had left it by mistake, thinking she had tucked it into her work basket. Vivian opened it. She read only a few lines before her expression became something cold and pleased and perfectly terrible. She tore out a single page and returned to the drawing room. She waited for the precise moment when enough people were present and the room had reached that particular pitch of amiable noise that made silence, when it came, land all the harder. Then she began to read aloud. "His smile is the warmest thing I have ever been near," Vivian read, her voice carrying perfectly. "I know it is foolish. I know I am no one to him. But when Lord John Kensington looks at me, I feel, just for a moment, as though being seen might be enough." The room did not go silent all at once. It went silent the way a fire goes out, first the edges, then the center, until there was nothing left but ash and the faint, terrible sound of Vivian Stirling's voice finishing the last line. 2 ladies near the window began to laugh. It was not the kind of laughter that included you. It was the sharp, bright kind that peeled you back like a rend. "A steward's daughter," one of them murmured to the other, just loudly enough, imagining herself in love with Lord John Kensington. "Ambitious is one word for it," the other replied. A third woman, whose name Scarlet didn't know and would never wish to, shook her head with a sympathy so theatrical it made the cruelty worse. "The poor creature. Has she no idea how she looks? No fortune, no family, no prospects. Lord John would not even remember her name by Thursday." Scarlet stood very still. Her needle was still in her hand. She had not dropped it. She had not moved. Something in her had understood, the instant she heard Vivian begin to read, that any movement at all, any flinch, any rise of color in her cheeks, any trembling of her jaw, would only sharpen their appetite. she would not give them that. But inside, in the place where pride lived adjacent to grief, she was unraveling completely. The page was her handwriting. Those were her words, private, honest, embarrassing in their sincerity. She had written them 3 months ago, in a weak moment after Lord John had handed her down from a carriage with unnecessary care, and she had felt, briefly and stupidly, that it meant something. It had meant nothing. She understood that now with the particular clarity of public humiliation. Perhaps she imagines the Duke himself might notice her next, Vivian said, her tone light, conversational, as if she were merely sharing an amusing anecdote rather than carefully dismantling another woman. After all, if one sets one's sights on one Kensington, why not reach for both? Laughter again, brighter this time. Scarlet set down her needle. She was preparing to stand, to walk out of that room with whatever dignity she could carry, when the atmosphere shifted. It happened the way weather changes on the moors, without announcement, without warning. The door at the far end of the drawing room opened, and Augustus Kensington, Duke of Greystone, walked in. The laughter did not stop immediately. It took a few seconds for the sound to register, for eyes to track toward the door, for the room to recalibrate itself. But once it did, the silence came complete and total, the way silence only does in the presence of someone with genuine power. Augustus was 34 years old. He was tall in the way that his brother was also tall, but where John's height felt open and approachable, Augustus's felt like something else, entirely, like the height of a cliff, or a storm front, or any other natural thing that was beautiful, precisely because it did not care whether you admired it. His hair was darker than his brother's, closer to black, and he wore it combed back with the severe neatness of a man who had no patience for disorder in any form. His eyes were the deep gray of winter sky just before it decides to do something serious. He rarely attended afternoon gatherings. Everyone in the room knew this. He took in the scene in a single glance. Vivian Sterling with the paper in her hand, the arranged cruelty on her face, the laughter still retreating from the room like a tide. And then his gaze moved to Scarlet. He looked at her for only a moment, but it was the kind of look that missed nothing. The too straight spine, the white knuckles around the needle she had picked up again, the precise angle of her chin that said she was refusing, by sheer force of will, to show them that she was breaking. He crossed the room. He crossed it with the unhurried, absolute certainty of a man who had never once in his life needed to hurry to be obeyed. He stopped in front of Vivian Sterling and held out his hand. The silence was enormous. Vivian blinked. For just an instant, something uncertain moved across her face. Then she placed the journal page in his gloved palm, because not doing so had simply not occurred to her as an option. Augustus looked at the page. He folded it once, cleanly, and then he said, "That belongs to me." 3 words. Quiet. Absolute. Carrying the weight of a man who had never found it necessary to raise his voice to make a room obey. No one spoke. Vivian's lips parted, then closed. The ladies near the window exchanged a glance of pure bewilderment. Augustus turned from Vivian to Scarlet and crossed to where she sat. He placed the folded page on the edge of her work basket, and their fingers did not quite touch, but they came close enough that she felt the warmth of his gloved hand just above hers, close enough that for one extraordinary second, the air between them felt charged with something she had no language for. He did not look at her with pity. He did not look at her with condescension or obligation or any of the 100 varieties of gracious contempt she had learned to recognize in 4 months at Greystone Court. He looked at her the way a person looks at something they have been trying very hard not to look at for a very long time. Then he turned and left the room. He did not explain. He did not elaborate. He simply withdrew, as though the matter was entirely concluded and any further discussion of it beneath consideration. The room remained stunned for a full 10 seconds after the door closed behind him. Then noise returned, slowly, carefully, like people wading back into a pond after something large had moved through it. Scarlett did not move. Her hand rested over the folded journal page in her work basket, and she stared at nothing, her mind turning the last 3 minutes over and over like a stone in a river. She told herself he had acted from obligation. She told herself it was duty, the same duty that had given her a place at Greystone Court in the first place, the Kensington family paying a debt through small acts of protection that cost them nothing and meant nothing beyond honor satisfied. She believed this because it was the sensible thing to believe. She was wrong. In his study at the east end of the manor, Augustus stood at the window, looking out at the frozen garden below. The journal page was in his hand. He had taken it back from Vivian because Scarlett could not have done it herself, not without making things worse. It was a simple, necessary act. He told himself this. Then he looked down at Scarlett's handwriting. The looping, careful letters, the honest and unguarded words she had written about his brother, and something moved through him that he had no intention of examining. He placed the page in the grate and watched it burn. He was furious, not at Scarlett, never at Scarlett, at the room, at Vivian Sterling's calculated cruelty, at the women who had laughed, at his brother, whose effortless warmth pulled every woman in his orbit toward him without the faintest understanding of what it cost them when he eventually moved on to the next smile, the next room, the next charming exchange. At himself, for caring. He turned from the window. He had known Scarlett Holloway for 4 months. He had known of her longer, Thomas Holloway's daughter, the girl his mother had written about in letters with such quiet affection. The girl who read in the library when she thought no one was watching. The girl who argued gently with the gardener about the placement of the winter bulbs and was, according to that same gardener, entirely correct about it. The girl who looked at John as though he hung the moon. Augustus pressed 2 fingers to the bridge of his nose and stood very still in the silence of his study. He had work to do. He had a masquerade ball to host in 3 weeks' time. He would not think about Scarlett Holloway. He thought about her for the next 3 hours. Hey, how are you feeling right now? Thank you so much for being here. It really means the world to me. I am working toward 10,000 subscribers, and if Scarlett's story is already pulling at your heart, please subscribe, smash the like button, and leave a hype on this video. Also, please rate this video. It helps me understand what you love so I can serve you better. Now let's get back to it, because the Duke just saved her from the worst humiliation of her life, and nobody in that room understands why. Not even Scarlett. Greystone Court transformed itself for the winter masquerade. 3 weeks of preparation produced something that seemed to belong to another world entirely, a world where candlelight was the only truth and everything solid became suggestion. Silver garlands wound up the banisters of the grand staircase. Crystal chandeliers blazed so brightly above the ballroom that looking up at them felt like looking at captured stars. Every surface that could be gilded had been gilded, and every surface that could not was dressed in deep green velvet and white ribbon. The smell of the house changed. Candle wax and pine, champagne and orange blossom, and even the shadows seemed to move differently, slower and more deliberate, as though the night itself had agreed to cooperate with the occasion. The guests arrived in masks and costumes, their faces half hidden behind silk and feather, which had the curious effect of making everyone, simultaneously, more mysterious and more honest. When your face is partially covered, something releases. You say things you wouldn't say. You stand closer. You stay longer near the things that pull at you. Scarlet wore a dress that the Dowager Duchess had pressed upon her, ivory silk with pale gold embroidery along the bodice, borrowed pearls at her throat, a simple ivory half-mask trimmed with cream ribbon. It was the finest thing she had worn in her life, and she was acutely, painfully aware of this as she descended the stairs with the Dowager Duchess on her arm. She was there only because Adelaine Kensington had made it quite clear that she would attend no event without her companion, and that was the end of it. Scarlet was grateful. She was also terrified. The room was dazzling. She found a place near the edge of the dancing, close enough to feel the warmth of the gathered crowd, but not so near that she could be easily drawn into conversation. She watched the dancing with the composed expression of someone who had learned that composure, applied consistently enough, could pass for contentment. And then Lord John was beside her. He was magnificent in dark evening dress and a black half-mask, his smile the same brilliant, easy thing it always was. Unchanged and perhaps unchangeable by costume or occasion or anything at all. "Miss Holloway," he said in that warm and careless voice, "you look remarkable tonight." Scarlet's heart did what it always did when he addressed her directly. She answered simply, steadily, because she was practiced at appearing steadier than she felt. "You are very kind, my lord." They spoke for a few minutes. Nothing of consequence, nothing that would be remembered by either of them tomorrow morning. But he looked at her while they spoke, and the looking felt like warmth after cold, and she could not quite protect herself from it. He was called away eventually. He was always being called away, always wanted by someone. And Scarlet was alone again, at the edge of the ballroom, watching the candles shiver. Lady Vivian Stirling arrived at her elbow 20 minutes later. She was dressed in deep violet with a silver mask, and she carried a small crystal glass of champagne with the proprietary ease of a woman entirely certain of her welcome in any room. She had not spoken to Scarlet since the afternoon in the drawing room, and her current expression held none of the contempt she had shown then. She looked instead pleasant and conspiratorial, which was considerably more alarming. "Miss Holloway," she said softly, "I wonder if I might speak with you." Scarlet looked at her carefully. "Of course. I owe you an apology for last week." Vivian's voice was measured, warm, entirely convincing. "What I did was unkind. I have been thinking about it since, and I am genuinely sorry." Scarlet said nothing. She waited. "I tell you this because I want you to believe what I say next." Vivian leaned slightly closer. "Lord John spoke to me this afternoon. He asked whether I thought you might meet him privately this evening. He was embarrassed to ask you himself. He said he wanted to surprise you." Something fierce and bright moved through Scarlet's chest. She pressed it down immediately. "Why would Lord John speak to you about such a thing?" "We are old friends," Vivian smiled. "He trusts my discretion. He said he wanted to apologize for not defending you last week when I behaved so badly. He is ashamed of himself, I think." It was, Scarlet had to admit, not impossible. John had been warm to her in the days since the drawing room incident. Warmer than before, actually, as though the event had stirred something in him. He had brought her a flower from the conservatory, a small white orchid, and she had kept it pressed between the pages of a book. Her caution said, "This is too convenient." Something about the timing, the setting, the way Vivian's kindness sat precisely where cruelty had sat before. Something said no. But her heart said, "What if it's true?" "The moonlit conservatory," Vivian said softly, pressing a small dark silk blindfold into Scarlet's palm. "He said to wear this. He wanted it to be a surprise." She smiled again, soft, secret, almost kind. "A romantic surprise, Miss Holloway. Is that not worth a little trust?" Scarlet looked down at the silk in her hand. She should not go. She went. The conservatory was at the rear of the manor, a long glassed room of arching iron and frosted panes through which the moonlight fell in pale broken sheets. Orange blossom trees stood in clay pots along the center aisle. They should not have been blooming in winter, but the Dowager Duchess insisted on them, and they obliged her, scenting the cold air with something sweet and impossible. Scarlet stood in the center of the conservatory and tied the blindfold. Darkness. The moonlight gone. The orange blossom still there, closer somehow in the dark, filling her lungs with sweetness. The sound of the ball faint and remote, as though it belonged to another world. She waited. She had been standing there perhaps 3 minutes when she heard footsteps. They were unhurried, deliberate, heavier than she expected from a man of John's easy grace. "Lord John," she whispered. Silence. The footsteps stopped. Then nothing, just the faint sound of breath in the cold air, slow and controlled, and the sense of a presence filling the dark around her, the way a warm body fills a cold room. A gloved hand touched her cheek. Scarlet went very still. The touch was careful, tentative, but not uncertain, as though the hand knew exactly what it was doing and was choosing, deliberately, to be gentle about it. The glove's leather was warm from a pocket, and beneath it she could feel the solidity of large, careful fingers. This was not the touch of a man performing a romantic gesture. This was the touch of someone who had waited a very long time and was no longer entirely certain they could wait any longer. Her breath came unevenly. The hand moved from her cheek to her chin, tilting it upward, not roughly, not with anything approaching demand, but with a slow, absolute certainty that made every nerve in her body go silent and attentive. He leaned toward her. She knew it the way you know the approach of a storm before the first sound of thunder. The air changed, the warmth increased, and then his mouth touched hers. It was not what she had imagined a first kiss to be. She had imagined something bright and sweet and swift, the way Lord John did everything, lightly, merrily, moving on before the moment could gather real weight. This was nothing like that. This was slow and searching and devastatingly careful, the way a man kisses something he is terrified of losing. There was no lightness in it. There was no carelessness. There was only a depth of feeling so carefully restrained, even now, even here, that the restraint itself was more eloquent than any declaration she had ever heard. She felt claimed and cherished and entirely undone. And she felt, somewhere beneath the sweetness of it, something she could not name, a recognition that her mind was too scattered to pursue, a sense that this did not feel like anything she had ever associated with John Kensington. Then he was gone. The warmth withdrew, the footsteps retreated, the door at the far end of the conservatory opened and closed. Scarlet stood alone in the orange blossom dark for a full minute before she raised her hands and pulled off the blindfold. Moonlight returned. No one was there. She stood breathing in the cold air, her fingers pressed to her mouth, her pulse loud in her ears, her mind assembling and reassembling the last 3 minutes with the desperate focus of someone trying to read a letter in bad light. She believed it was John. She believed it with the perfect, trusting confidence of a woman who had wanted it to be John for so long that the wanting had become a kind of certainty. She was absolutely, entirely wrong. In the shadowed corridor beyond the conservatory door, Augustus Kensington stood with his back against the wall and his eyes closed. He had gone there to stop it. He had seen Vivian Sterling speak to Scarlett. He had seen the blindfold, small and dark in the lamplight, passed between them. He had known, with the particular clarity of someone who had spent 3 weeks watching Vivian Sterling for exactly this kind of cruelty, precisely what the woman was doing. Vivian had set a trap. Not a kind one. The conservatory was dark. Anyone could have walked through. Scarlett, blindfolded, would have had no way to verify whom she was meeting. The humiliation potential was considerable. Augustus had followed. He had arrived in the conservatory doorway, intending to tell Scarlett to take the blindfold off, to tell her the whole thing was a fabrication, to protect her, as he had always protected her, from a careful distance, without getting close enough to want more than distance. But Scarlett had been standing in the moonlight with the blindfold already in place, and her face, turned upward in the cold, trusting and hopeful and heartbreakingly open, had destroyed every intention he arrived with. He had told himself, every day for 4 months, that what he felt for her was duty, a promise to her father's memory, a responsibility born of his family's debt. He had been lying to himself for 4 months. He knew it absolutely, standing in the conservatory doorway, watching Scarlett Holloway wait for a man who was not coming. He should have left. He should have announced himself, explained, sent her back to the ballroom, done anything except what he did. What he did was cross the room. He should not have. He knew that. He had known it every second of those long, quiet steps toward her, and the knowledge had not stopped him, because there are things that years of restraint cannot, in the end, actually restrain, and this was one of them. And now he stood in the corridor with his eyes closed, shaken to his foundations by the understanding that he had just kissed Scarlett Holloway, while she believed him to be his brother. He had no idea what to do with that. He had no idea what to do with any of it. He pushed off the wall and walked back toward the ballroom with the measured step of a man who had absolutely everything under control, which he did not. He had nothing under control whatsoever. The morning after the masquerade, Greystone Court returned to itself. Gowns put away, candles extinguished, silver garlands removed and coiled back into storage. But something in the house had changed. There was a different quality to the air, a subtle reordering of the invisible lines that connected the people within it. Scarlett felt it most in herself. She moved through her morning duties with the careful attention of someone carrying something fragile and precious in both hands. She read to the Dowager Duchess for an hour. She helped sort the post that had arrived. She walked in the garden for 20 minutes in the thin winter sunlight, and the cold air against her face felt, for the first time since she had arrived at Greystone Court, like something she was allowed to enjoy, because she believed she was loved. Not openly. Not yet. But she believed, with all the bright, careful hope of someone who had waited a long time for something to want her back, that Lord John Kensington had stood in the moonlit conservatory and told her so in the only language that needed no words. She was not a foolish woman. She knew the practical difficulties. She knew that a lord and a companion, a fortune and none at all, were not natural partners in the eyes of the world. She knew any number of things with her sensible, practical mind. Her heart simply did not find these things relevant this morning. Lord John appeared at luncheon. He was his usual self, warm, easy, handsome, moving through the room like a man entirely comfortable in every space he entered. He sat near the center of the table, told a story that made three people laugh, and helped himself to wine with the relaxed confidence of someone who had never spent a single anxious second at a meal in his life. He noticed Scarlet. More precisely, he noticed the way Scarlet was looking at him. There was something different in her eyes this morning. Softer, more luminous, less carefully hidden than usual. It was the look of a woman who believed she held a secret and was barely containing her pleasure in it. John was perceptive in the way that attractive, charming people so often are. Not deeply, not at any real cost to himself, but sharply enough to read a room and an expression. He read Scarlett's expression with pleasant surprise and the particular vanity of a man who enjoyed being looked at as though he held the answers. He had not, of course, been in the conservatory. He had spent the masquerade's quieter middle hours in the card room with Lord Pemberton and two other men, winning a satisfying amount at whist. He had not arranged anything with Vivian Sterling. He had not asked for a private meeting with Scarlet Holloway. But he looked at Scarlet looking at him, and something in him that was more appetite than affection stirred with mild interest. Over the following week, he gave her attention. It began simply, a flower from the conservatory, brought with an easy smile and set on her work basket while she sewed. A comment about her hair, made in passing with the kind of specificity that implied he had actually looked at it. An invitation to walk in the garden, extended with that particular warmth he could produce at will, the warmth that felt personal, because he aimed it so directly. Scarlet walked with him. She listened to him talk, about horses, about London, about a trip to the continent he was planning, and she filled in the spaces between his words with meaning she believed was implied. She heard him say, "I admire your patience," and understood it as more than it was. She noticed when his glance lingered, and told herself it was the same kind of noticing she felt, the same depth, the same weight. She was wrong about almost all of it. John liked being the subject of that particular look in her eyes. He liked it in the mild, pleasant way. He liked a good pair of boots, appreciative, comfortable, not particularly invested in where the boots had come from or where they intended to go. Augustus watched from a distance. He watched from windows and doorways. He watched from the far end of dining tables and the edge of rooms he had no reason to enter, but entered anyway. He watched his brother give Scarlet a flower and felt something move through his chest that he would have called indigestion in anyone but himself. He watched Scarlet's face soften when John spoke to her, and the softening was so visible, so unguarded, that it required a specific and deliberate act of will each time to remain where he was rather than cross the room. He told himself, "She is free to choose. She is free to make every mistake she intends to make." He told himself, "John is my brother." He told himself, "I have no claim on her." None of it helped. He lasted 9 days before he found Scarlet alone in the rose garden, on a morning when frost had turned the bare hedges silver white and the air was so cold it turned breath to mist. She was walking slowly, her hands folded in front of her, her face tilted slightly upward to catch the thin winter sun. She looked, as she so often looked, when she thought no one was watching, like someone permitting herself a small and private happiness. Augustus came to stand beside her. She looked up, startled, and immediately composed herself, a habit she had around him that he recognized because he had the same habit around her. "Your Grace," she said, quietly. "Miss Holloway." He fell into step beside her. They walked in silence for a moment, the frost crunching softly beneath their feet. Then he said, without preamble, because he had never learned the art of approaching things indirectly, I want to speak to you about my brother. A small change in her expression, something pulled slightly tighter. Lord John? He is not. He stopped, revised, tried again. John is a man of great warmth. I do not dispute that. But his warmth is not. He looked for the right word and settled, unhappily, on the most accurate one. It is not particular. Scarlet was quiet for a beat. Then she said, with perfect, brittle calm, I see. I am not saying this to wound you. Are you not? She stopped walking, turned to face him with the grey-green eyes that were dark today, storm-coloured. Then what are you saying, Your Grace? That I am foolish? That I am reaching above myself? That I should be grateful for the position I hold and stop imagining I might be wanted as anything more than a useful companion for your mother? Something moved across his face, brief, quickly controlled. That is not what I said. It is what you meant. No, he said, and something in his voice shifted, tightened, as though he were holding a door closed against something pushing at it from the other side. What I meant is that John is careless with women's hearts. He does not mean to be. But he does not distinguish between the warmth he gives freely to everyone and the warmth that means something. And I would not have you. He stopped again. I promised your father's memory that you would be protected here. Scarlet looked at him for a long, terrible moment. So that is all I am to you, Your Grace, she said softly. Not a question. A verdict. A promise. Yes, he said. It was the hardest lie he had ever told. Scarlet nodded once, with the careful dignity of someone reassembling herself in public view, and said, Then you have done your duty, and I thank you for it, and walked away. Augustus stood in the rose garden and watched her go, and hated himself with the thorough, focused efficiency he brought to everything. Behind the tall, frozen hedges, in a spot she had not been visible from the garden path, Lady Vivian Stirling pressed her gloved fingers together and considered what she had just overheard. The Duke of Greystone did not look at Scarlet Holloway like a man honouring an obligation. He looked at her like a man drowning on dry land. Vivian's next steps became considerably more urgent. London's aristocracy ran on two things, money and story. Lady Vivian Stirling had enough of both to be devastating. She began simply. A word here, a carefully worded observation there, delivered in the confidential tone of a woman sharing a concern rather than orchestrating a campaign. At a dinner in Mayfair, she mentioned, with apparent reluctance, that Miss Holloway had arranged a private meeting at the masquerade ball. She did not say with whom. The omission was deliberate and far more damaging than any name would have been, because it allowed every person in the room to fill in the gap with their own imagination, which invariably produced something worse than the truth. By the end of that week, the rumor had acquired specifics it had never actually possessed. Scarlet Holloway had trapped Lord John in a private meeting. Scarlet Holloway was attempting to secure a proposal above her station. Scarlet Holloway, the steward's daughter, was using her position in the Kensington household to engineer an advantageous marriage by any means available. The story spread with the efficient malice of something well-seeded and frequently watered. Scarlet felt it immediately. The first sign was Small, a lady she had spoken with pleasantly at the previous month's gathering, who now found reasons to be on the other side of every room. Then invitations to afternoon calls that stopped arriving. Then the servants, who had always been professionally neutral, beginning to look at her with something that was not quite pity and not quite contempt, but lived somewhere in the uncomfortable territory between. She carried herself through all of it with the steady composure that had become, over 4 months at Greystone Court, her most reliable defense. But the composure was expensive, and she paid for it in the hours after midnight, when the house went quiet, and she sat at the small writing desk in her room, with her journal open, and wrote nothing, because there was too much to say, and no safe place to put any of it. Lord John did not defend her. She had not expected him to. Not precisely, not with any specificity. But she had held a small, soft hope, the kind that lived mostly below the level of conscious thought, that the warmth he had shown her these past weeks meant something, that when a story about her character circulated through the drawing rooms of people who knew him, he might say something. Not a declaration, not a risk, just a word. He said nothing. She watched him navigate the social landscape around the rumor with the practiced ease of a man who had long ago learned to protect his own comfort first, and she saw him clearly, perhaps for the first time, without the warm light she had always placed him in. He was not cruel. She did not think him cruel. He simply prioritized himself with such automatic, unexamined thoroughness that other people's pain simply did not register in any sustained way. Augustus saw it too. He said nothing about it to John. Not then. But Scarlett watched the Duke's expression at dinner grow colder by degrees, watched him look at his brother with a measuring silence that was not anger exactly, but was something adjacently precise and equally uncomfortable. The library conversation happened on a Wednesday evening, 12 days into Scarlett's social exile. She had gone to return a volume of essays to the Greystone Court Library, the kind of large wood-paneled room that smelled of old leather and wood ash, where candles burned low in iron holders and the shelves ran floor to ceiling on 3 walls. She had not expected anyone to be there at 9 o'clock in the evening. Augustus was standing at the far shelf when she entered, reading by the light of a single candle, his expression absent and focused in the way of a man who reads not for leisure, but out of genuine need, as though books were a functioning part of his mental machinery, necessary and habitual. He looked up when she came in. She started to apologize and withdraw. "Stay," he said. Not a command, not quite. Something quieter. She stayed. She returned her book to its place on the second shelf. He returned to his reading. They existed in the same room without speaking for several minutes, and it was not uncomfortable, which was itself slightly alarming, because she could not recall a time when silence with Augustus Kensington had felt like anything other than the charged quiet before a difficult exchange. This was different. This was simply two people sharing a room with a fire and candlelight. She sat in the chair near the reading table. He remained standing, but he turned slightly, not facing her, but angled toward her, as though the reading was now secondary. "You are not sleeping," he said. It was not quite a question. Scarlett looked up. "I sleep adequately. You have circles under your eyes that were not there 2 weeks ago." She was quiet for a moment. "The rumors are unpleasant," she said finally. It was not a complaint, just an acknowledgement. "They will stop." "Will they?" She sounded more tired than she intended. "I find that in my experience, things of this nature do not simply stop. They change shape." He closed his book and set it on the shelf. He moved to the other chair, the one across the reading table from her, close enough that the candlelight reached both of them. He sat. "Why do you always look at me as though you are angry?" she asked, before she could think better of asking it. He was quiet for long enough that she thought he would not answer. Then, "Because you keep offering your heart to people who do not know its worth." The fire crackled. A candle guttered. The silence between them filled with something she did not have a name for. She looked at him, really looked, the way she had been carefully not looking for weeks, and found him looking back, not with the cold, appraising gaze he used on the rest of the world, with something else, something that had been behind all the rest of it, the whole time, waiting. Her breath came shorter. He was on his feet before she registered that he had moved, standing, leaning slightly toward her across the table, his hand near hers on the polished surface. Not touching, but near. "Miss Holloway," he said, and his voice had dropped to something barely above quiet, and something in the sound of it moved through her like a key turning in a lock. "I think you should leave. Before I do something that..." He stopped, corrected himself. "Before I forget what is proper." She stood, her chair scraped slightly on the floor. She gathered herself, which took considerably more effort than it should have, and she crossed to the door. She paused with her hand on the frame. "Good night, Your Grace," she said, without turning around. "Good night, Miss Holloway." She went. Outside the library door, she pressed her back against the corridor wall and stood very still, her heart entirely unreasonable in her chest, and tried to understand what had just happened and why her body, which was generally sensible, was now insisting that it already knew. Inside the library, Augustus sat down again, pressed his fingers to his temples, and stared at the fire for a very long time. January brought cold that was no longer elegant. The frost that had made Greystone Court beautiful in December became something harsher in the new year. Driving, relentless, ice forming on the inside of window panes, and making every exterior journey a negotiation between necessity and sense. Vivian Sterling had assessed the library scene. She had not overheard it, but she had seen Scarlett exit the library with that particular stillness that comes after something significant, and she had seen Augustus's face the following morning at breakfast, carefully and unsuccessfully neutral, and drawn her conclusions. The Duke was in love with the steward's daughter. The knowledge was clarifying, not devastating. Vivian was not a woman who permitted herself devastation over things she had not truly possessed, but clarifying in the cold, efficient way of someone recalculating strategy. She could not fight love with gossip, but she could remove the object of it. She arranged it carefully, as she arranged everything. There was a dinner party at Haverley House, 2 miles east of Greystone, 3 evenings hence. Scarlett would attend as the Dowager Duchess's companion. The Dowager Duchess was feeling unwell and would stay behind. Scarlett, however, was expected, as several of the hostess's letters had addressed her specifically. Vivian arranged, through a footman she compensated generously and would never acknowledge, that the carriage assigned to bring Scarlett back to Greystone Court that evening would have one wheel pin removed and replaced with something considerably less reliable. She told herself Scarlett would simply be stranded, inconvenienced, perhaps frightened. The wheel would fail within the first mile, on the flat stretch before the road descended to the river crossing. She had not calculated on the storm. The weather turned 2 hours into the dinner. Rain arrived from the north in sheets, turned quickly vicious, and the river near the crossing swelled with the speed that only English January rivers can manage, going from shallow and passable to something else entirely in the space of an hour. By the time Scarlett climbed into the carriage and the driver started toward Greystone Court at 9:30, the road was barely visible and the night was the color of nothing at all. The carriage wheel failed at the worst possible moment, at the top of the slope that descended to the river crossing, where the road curved and the bank dropped away sharply to the left. The pin went. The wheel tilted. The driver shouted. The horses screamed. And the carriage went over. At Greystone Court, Augustus was at his desk when the message arrived. A breathless stable boy, soaking wet, with a note from the Haverley House coachman, who had seen Scarlett's carriage depart and grown uneasy about the weather. The note said only that the carriage had not been seen to return, and the storm was severe. Augustus was on horseback before the boy had finished speaking. He had no coherent thought during the ride through the storm. He was not a man accustomed to the absence of coherent thought, and its absence now was itself a form of information. His mind had reduced itself to a single driving point. Find her. He found the carriage at the river crossing. The vehicle lay on its side in the mud at the base of the slope, one wheel still slowly turning in the rain. The horses had been cut free by the driver, who was injured but conscious and directing a lantern toward the riverbank with shaking hands. "She's inside, Your Grace," the man said. "Trapped. I couldn't... my arm..." Augustus did not wait for the rest. He got Scarlett out. It was not elegant or simple. The door was jammed, and the frame had buckled, and the water from the swollen bank was beginning to reach the side of the overturned carriage in dark, icy fingers. He forced the door with his shoulder, twice, and on the third attempt it gave, and he reached into the dark interior and found her. She was conscious, barely. She had struck her head on the carriage frame, and her shoulder was wrong. Not broken, he thought, but damaged. And she was soaked through to the bone, and shaking so hard that the shaking itself seemed to require effort. He lifted her out. He carried her through the rain to the abandoned gatehouse at the edge of the Greystone estate grounds, 50 yards, perhaps. Far enough. He got the door open with his shoulder and brought her inside. The gatehouse had not been used in years, but it had a fireplace with dry wood stacked beside it, and Augustus built a fire with the focused, practical urgency of a man who understood that warmth was the only thing that mattered. He removed his coat and wrapped it around Scarlett's shoulders. He knelt in front of her and took her hands in his and chafed them, rubbing her cold fingers between his palms, pressing them briefly to his lips to warm them, saying her name in a low, steady voice as the fire began to catch. Scarlett. First time he had used her given name. It came out of him without decision. She was looking at the fire, coming back to herself by degrees. She had stopped shaking quite so violently. The color was returning to her face in slow, fragile increments. "I am all right," she said, in a voice that was thin but determined. "You are not all right. You will be all right. Those are different things." She almost smiled. "Are you always precise, Your Grace? Even in a crisis?" "Especially in a crisis." He was still kneeling in front of her. Her hands were in his, and he had not released them, and the fire was beginning to fill the small room with warmth. She was looking at him now, fully, without the careful management she usually applied to looking at him, and he was looking back, and they were very close in the low firelight with the rain hammering the gatehouse roof and no one else within half a mile. He reached up and touched her face, gently, with the backs of his fingers, brushing rain from her cheek. She did not move. He leaned forward and kissed her. There was nothing calculated in it. No thought. No decision. Only the pure, unmanaged truth of a man who had spent 4 months refusing to feel what he felt, and who had just ridden through a storm to find her, and was currently failing entirely at restraint. He kissed her the way he had kissed her in the conservatory, with that same aching tenderness, that same depth of feeling held in careful hands, that same quality of a man who knew the value of what he was touching and was terrified of breaking it. Scarlett went very still. Something moved through her, below thought, below language, a recognition so deep and physical that she felt it the way you feel a key fitting a lock, not with surprise, but with the breathless conviction of something confirmed. The conservatory, the blindfold, the silence, the same breath, the same warmth, the same impossible gentleness. She pulled back. He let her. She looked at his face in the firelight, the strong jaw, the grey eyes, the expression that was now entirely unguarded for the first time since she had known him, and she said, in a voice that barely cleared a whisper, "It was you." The silence between those words and his response was the loudest silence she had ever sat in. Augustus closed his eyes. He did not speak. He did not have to. "The conservatory," Scarlet said. "The masquerade. It was never..." She stopped. The thing was too large to hold all at once. "It was you. The whole time. It was you." "Yes," he said quietly. "I am sorry." She searched his face. "Are you?" He opened his eyes. "Not for what I felt. Only for the manner of it. You believed... I let you believe something false. That was wrong." Scarlet looked at the fire. Outside, the rain continued its furious assault on the gatehouse roof. Inside, warmth built steadily between them. "Why?" she asked. Not accusation, genuine searching. "Why did you come to the conservatory at all?" "To stop Vivian's trap." He paused. "And then I lost the ability to do what I intended." She looked at him again. "What did you intend?" "To leave." His voice was quiet and entirely honest. "I intended to leave." Scarlet sat in the warmth of his coat around her shoulders and the fire beside her, and the admission settling between them, and she did not know what she felt, except that it was enormous and complicated, and not at all what she had expected the evening to produce. "We need to get back to the house," she said, eventually. "Yes," he agreed. Neither of them moved immediately. The storm was still going. Scarlet changed after the gatehouse. Not dramatically, not in any way that would be obvious to anyone who was not paying close attention. But she moved through Greystone Court differently in the days that followed, with a careful, internal quietness that was not the same as the composed distance she had maintained before. This was not armor. It was the stillness of someone actively engaged with something important, turning it over in the private interior of themselves with the focused honesty it deserved. She stopped waiting for John. She had not, she realized, been consciously waiting, but she had been, in the invisible way of habits formed without intention, listening for his voice in corridors, angling herself toward rooms he frequented, keeping her eyes slightly toward the door when he was expected. She stopped all of it. John noticed within 3 days. He noticed because the quality of Scarlet's attention, which had been warm and soft and directed at him, had simply ceased to be directed at him at all, and the absence was more conspicuous than its presence had been. It was not that she was cold toward him. She was perfectly pleasant, perfectly mannered, and entirely elsewhere. He found her in the garden on a Thursday afternoon, when the weather had briefly relented enough to make the stone paths walkable. He was charming. He was warm. He smiled at her with the full, practiced brightness of that smile. "You have been hiding from me," he said, lightly. "Not at all, my lord." She kept walking. "I have simply been occupied." "Scarlet." He stepped alongside her, his voice shifting from charm to something slightly more earnest. "I know the last weeks have been difficult. The rumors, I should have spoken sooner. I am sorry for that." She stopped. She looked at him with a directness she had never quite managed before, because she had always been too occupied with wanting him to see him clearly. She saw him now. She saw a handsome, warm, fundamentally self-centered man who was, at this particular moment, experiencing the unfamiliar discomfort of losing something he had not valued until it was leaving. "You are apologizing now," she said quietly, "because I have stopped looking at you the way I used to." Something in his expression shifted. Less charm, something more genuine but less comfortable. "Is that wrong?" "No," she said. "It is honest. I appreciate the honesty." She began to walk again. "But I do not love you, Lord John. I do not think I ever truly did. I think I loved the idea of being chosen by someone who seemed very sure of himself. It is not the same thing." He took her hand. Not gently, with the quick urgency of a man who had realized, abruptly and badly, that he wanted what he was about to lose. "I could choose you," he said, "properly, if that is what." "Release her hand." Augustus's voice came from the garden path behind them, low, quiet, the kind of quiet that had nothing soothing in it. John released Scarlett's hand. He turned. The two brothers faced each other across 6 feet of frost-white garden path, and the air between them had the particular charge of something that had been building for months and was no longer interested in being managed. "You have no right to—" John began. "She asked to continue walking," Augustus said. "You stopped her." "That is sufficient." "This is between Scarlett and me. Her name," Augustus said, in a voice that had gone completely flat, "is Miss Holloway." John's jaw tightened. "Do not take that tone with me. She is not your property." "She is no one's property. That is rather the point you seem to be missing. You love her." John said it with the abruptness of someone arriving at an unwelcome revelation mid-argument. "Good God, Augustus, you love her." The garden was entirely silent. Scarlett stood between them, and neither of them was looking at her now. They were looking at each other with the complicated history of brothers who had never quite spoken honestly about anything, finally out of room to avoid it. "She is beneath us both," John said. He said it badly, rashly, without thought, with the defensive reflex of a man trying to reassert a position he had already lost. "She is a steward's daughter. You are a duke. This is—" "Do not," Augustus said. "Finish that sentence." He said it quietly. But his voice had reached the place it only went when something he cared about with absolute completeness was threatened, and the sound of it stopped John's words as thoroughly as a door shut in a face. "You will not speak of her that way again," Augustus said. "In this house. Or anywhere." Silence stretched. John looked at his brother, then at Scarlett, then back at his brother, and something in his expression moved through anger and pride and wounded vanity, and arrived, reluctantly, at the truth of the situation. "She has already chosen," he said, quietly now. "Not graceful about it, but honest enough." "Hasn't she?" It was not a question directed at Scarlett. It was directed at Augustus, and what it was really asking was far larger than the word choose could hold. Augustus said nothing. Scarlett, who had been standing with her hands folded and her face composed and her heart somewhere in the vicinity of her throat, looked at Augustus and found him already looking at her. "Yes," she said softly. John nodded once. He straightened. He said, with the particular dignity of a man rearranging himself after a fall, "Then I wish you both well," and walked away down the garden path and did not look back. The garden was quiet. Augustus and Scarlett stood in it together, the air between them large with everything still unsaid. "You could lose a great deal," she said, "socially, courting me, after Vivian's stories." "I am aware. I have no fortune, no family name worth speaking of. I am your mother's companion. I know your circumstances." "Then you understand why this—" "I understand," he said, that I rode through a storm because I could not remain indoors knowing you might be in danger. I understand that I have been lying to myself for 4 months about the nature of what I feel for you, and I understand that whatever social arithmetic you are about to perform, it will not change any of those facts." She looked at him. He was, she thought, the most difficult man she had ever met. Reserved to the point of impenetrability, controlled to the point of frustration, possessed of an emotional vocabulary that required excavation rather than invitation. And he had come through the storm, and he had called her Scarlet in the dark of a gatehouse while her hands were cold and the fire was young, and he had kissed her in the conservatory because he could not make himself leave. She felt the Dowager Duchess's hand on her elbow before she heard the woman approach. Adeline Kensington had a remarkable talent for appearing at significant moments, whether by design or instinct. She was wrapped in a wool shawl and looking at them both with the quiet, pleased expression of a woman who knew things. "Augustus," the Dowager Duchess said, in a voice that carried the particular authority of 50 years of managing difficult Kensington men. "Love without courage is another word for cowardice." He looked at his mother. She looked back at him with absolute serenity. Then she patted Scarlett's hand and went back inside. That evening, a formal notice was dispatched from Greystone Court to the household of the Marchioness of Alderton, who was hosting the Grand Winter Ball in London the following week. It announced that His Grace, the Duke of Greystone, would attend, and that Miss Scarlet Holloway would attend as his personal guest. The night of the Grand Winter Ball, Scarlet stood in front of the small mirror in her room at Greystone Court and tried to recognize herself. The Dowager Duchess had sent a gown 3 days ago, delivered to Scarlet's room by a housemaid, with a note in Adeline Kensington's elegant hand that said only, "You have never needed anything to make you remarkable. But tonight, let them see it." The gown was deep emerald silk, cut with a simplicity that was more expensive than any ornamentation, with a modest neckline and long sleeves that made the green of it seem to deepen against her auburn hair. The borrowed pearls were back at her throat. She looked at herself and did not recognize the woman looking back. Not because she looked different, but because the woman in the glass was not flinching. That was new. Adeline Kensington herself helped pin her hair, a gesture so quietly kind that Scarlet had to look away to maintain her composure. And then the Dowager Duchess took her hands and held them and said, "My son is not a man who gives his heart easily. He has given it to you entirely. Whatever happens tonight, remember that." Scarlet nodded. Her voice was not available. She went down the stairs. Augustus was in the entrance hall. He was in black evening dress, severe and perfectly fitted, as all his clothes were, as though he had been designed with formality in mind. He wore no decorative embellishment. He never did. He did not need it, in the way that very few things that are genuinely imposing need decoration to register. He looked up when she descended. His expression did something she had never seen it do before. It opened. Not into warmth, exactly. He was not a man whose face would ever be warm in the way John's was warm, easy and ready, but into something else, something quieter and more permanent, the way bedrock is permanent beneath soil. He looked at her as though she were the specific, irreplaceable thing he had spent a very long time trying not to want. "You look," he began, stopped, revised, settled on. "You are ready?" "Terrified," she said honestly. "Good," he said. "That means you understand what we're walking into." She almost laughed. "That is not reassuring." It was not intended to be reassuring. It was intended to be accurate. He extended his arm. "Stay beside me." She took his arm. They drove to London in the ducal carriage, largely in silence, the comfortable kind, the kind that had no need to fill itself. Occasionally Augustus said something practical about the evening's guests, a warning or a piece of useful information, and Scarlet filed it away. She looked out the window at the passing darkness and felt, under the fear, something she had not expected. Clarity. She was no longer confused about what she wanted. She was no longer watching someone else's story and hoping for a place in it. She was in her own story now, and it had brought her here, to this carriage, on this night, beside this man. That was enough to be going on with. The Alderton townhouse blazed from every window. London's finest had assembled. The season's great names, the season's great fortunes, the season's great gossips, and the season's carefully arranged social hierarchies, all present and polished and ready to be witnessed. The announcement of the Duke of Greystone's arrival had preceded him by 20 minutes, as these things always did. And the announcement that he was arriving with Miss Scarlet Holloway, the steward's daughter, the companion, the subject of Vivian Sterling's recent campaign, had preceded that announcement by approximately 10. The ballroom knew they were coming before the doors opened. When the doors opened, the silence fell complete. Scarlet had braced herself for the moment, but bracing and experiencing were not the same. She felt the eyes as a physical thing, hundreds of them, turning, landing, assessing. She felt the whisper beginning at the room's far edges and moving inward like a tide. She felt her hand tighten, involuntarily, on Augustus's arm. His hand covered hers, brief, deliberate, utterly steady. They crossed the threshold. Vivian Sterling stood near the center of the room in deep blue silk, and Scarlet watched the color leave her face in a slow, controlled way that she handled with remarkable grace, all things considered. John was near the far wall, looking at a point somewhere above and to the left of his brother, which was the posture of a man working very hard at neutral. The Marchioness of Alderton was a small, formidable woman of 63, who had seen enough of society to find most of it predictable, and rather liked being surprised. She crossed to greet them with the alert expression of someone deciding, in real time, that this evening had just become considerably more interesting. "Your Grace," she said warmly. "And Miss Holloway, we are delighted." "The pleasure is ours," Augustus said, with the measured courtesy he produced as naturally as breathing. They circulated. It was the strangest hour of Scarlet's life. People who had previously looked through her now looked at her, which was not entirely more comfortable, but was at least different. Some of the looks were curious. Some were calculating. A few, from women who had not been party to Vivian's campaign and had formed no particular opinion of Scarlet Holloway, were simply warm. She was introduced twice as Augustus's guest. Both times he said it with the same quiet authority with which he said everything. And then the orchestra, which had been playing through several sets with admirable persistence, arrived at the first waltz of the evening. Augustus turned to her. "Will you dance with me, Miss Holloway?" She looked at him. "You dance?" The corners of his mouth moved, barely, but definitively. "Not often, and not with everyone." She took his hand. He danced the way she might have expected, with complete competence and no wasted motion, leading with the firm, guiding certainty that characterized everything he did. She matched him without difficulty. She had been taught by her mother and had always loved to dance, though she rarely got the opportunity. The room watched. She was aware of it without being undone by it. She kept her eyes on Augustus's face, the grey eyes, steady and present, looking at her and only at her as they moved, and she let the watching happen around them at whatever distance it chose. When the music ended, Augustus held her in place. He turned, with her still at his side, to face the assembled room. Scarlet felt the stillness settle. "Miss Scarlet Holloway," Augustus said, in the clear, carrying voice he used when he intended to be heard by everyone and chose that to be understood as deliberate, "is the daughter of Thomas Holloway, who served this family faithfully for 22 years, and who, at considerable personal cost, preserved my father's life. She has served this family with the same faithfulness, the same dignity, and the same quiet excellence that her father exemplified." He paused. "She has been treated poorly by people who ought to have known better. I am addressing that now." The room's silence had become the held breath kind. "Miss Holloway is not an opportunist. She is not an embarrassment. She is not a subject for gossip or a tool for anyone's social strategy." He looked, briefly, in Vivian Sterling's direction. Not an accusation. Not quite, just a noting. "She is the bravest, kindest, and most honorable woman I have ever known." Somewhere in the room, someone put down their glass very carefully. Augustus turned back to Scarlet. He looked at her. Only at her. And in his expression was everything he had been unable to say in rose gardens and libraries and gatehouse firelight. The 4 months of watching, the restraint, the choosing and refusing and choosing again, the storm and the conservatory, and the lie he had told her in the garden to protect himself from the truth he had known all along. He took both of her hands in his. "Miss Scarlet Holloway," he said, quietly now, still audible, because the room had gone that quiet, but quieter than an announcement, closer to something meant specifically for her. "I have been in love with you for longer than I will admit in present company. I should have said so months ago, and I did not. And I am asking your forgiveness for that, as well as for the conservatory, which I also should have handled differently." A small sound moved through the crowd, not quite laughter, closer to the collective recognition of something genuine in a room accustomed to performance. "Will you do me the very great honor," Augustus said, "of becoming my wife?" Scarlet looked at him. She was aware, distantly, of the ballroom, of Vivienne's carefully arranged expression, of John, who had turned to look at them properly now, with something on his face that was not quite bitterness and not quite grace, but was moving slowly toward the latter. Of the Marchioness of Alderton, whose expression had settled into the satisfied delight of a woman watching something excellent happen. She was aware of all of it, and she let it be there, and she chose not to be afraid of it. Then she looked at Augustus, and she did not look away. "You kissed me in the dark," she said softly, "and let me believe it was someone else." "Yes," he said. "I did." "And you rode through a storm." "Yes." "And you called my name in a gatehouse when you were frightened." "I was frightened," he said, without apology or qualification, which was itself the most extraordinary thing she had ever heard from this particular man. "And you told me I was only a promise," she said, "and you were lying." "Yes," he said. "I was." She felt her hands tighten around his. She thought of the woman she had been on the first day she came to Greystone Court, the careful, invisible woman who sat at the edge of rooms and watched other people's warmth from a distance, and told herself it was enough to simply be permitted to stay. She thought of every moment she had given her attention to a man who received it without noticing its cost. She thought of orange blossoms and moonlight and the specific quality of a kiss she had not understood. She had spent 4 months looking at the wrong brother. She had spent 4 months being seen by the right one. "Yes," she said. "I will marry you, Augustus." Something in his face, the last of whatever had been held in reserve, Whatever tightly maintained control had managed the grey eyes and the composed expressions through 4 months of wanting what he had decided he was not permitted to want. Released. He raised her hand and pressed his lips to her knuckles. Long and deliberate and entirely public. The room exhaled. Music began. Someone in the orchestra had the excellent instinct to start immediately, and the ballroom returned to itself around them, noise rising, conversations resuming, the particular animated quality of a room that had witnessed something and would be discussing it for weeks. Augustus turned to her and offered his hand for the dance. She took it. They moved to the center of the floor, and they danced, not the way they had danced before, with the room's eyes a present and managed thing between them. But now, with that awareness set aside, both of them, finally, utterly present with each other in the middle of the noise. He held her the way he did everything, with complete, absolute, unhurried certainty. One hand at her waist, one holding hers, both of them moving through the waltz with the easy fluency of people who have somehow, despite everything, arrived at the same place at the same time. You said Augustus, he observed after a turn. I did. In front of 500 people. Is that a complaint? No, he said. And the corners of his mouth moved again, more decisively this time. It is not. She looked at him, at the grey eyes that were warm now in a way she was fairly certain no one in this room had ever seen before. And she felt the last 4 months settle into sense. All of it. The journal page, and the drawing room, and the conservatory, and the rose garden, and the library, and the gatehouse, and the storm. All the careful distances, and the silences, and the things said, and the larger things unsaid. All of it resolving into this. The two of them, in the middle of a ballroom, surrounded by everyone who had once made her invisible. She was not invisible anymore. She was the woman Augustus Kensington, Duke of Greystone, had asked to marry him before all of London. She was the woman he had kissed in the dark when he could no longer make himself not. She was the woman he had ridden through a storm for, when every reasonable voice in his reasonable mind had given him 100 good reasons to remain indoors. She was chosen. Fully, deliberately, expensively chosen. Not because she had no better option, not because she was convenient, but because she was, in the estimation of the most precise and discerning man she had ever met, irreplaceable. The music filled the room, the candles blazed in the chandeliers above, and Scarlett Holloway, the daughter of a steward, the woman without fortune or family name, the woman who had sat at the edges of rooms for 4 months and tried to make herself useful enough to justify her presence, danced in the arms of the Duke of Greystone and did not once look toward the edge of the room. There was nothing there for her anymore. She was exactly where she was supposed to be. Later, much later, when the ball had thinned and the candles had burned lower and London's finest had dispersed into the cold night with enough to talk about for a full season, Augustus and Scarlett sat side by side in the ducal carriage returning to Greystone Court. The city lights moved past the window in slow, amber streaks. Scarlett rested her head against the carriage cushion and watched them. She was exhausted in the clean, good way that comes after something difficult has finally been completed. Augustus, she said. He looked at her. In the conservatory. When you kissed me. She watched his face. Did you know then? That you loved me? He considered this with the genuine, unhurried honesty she had come to understand was his most consistent quality. He did not dress things. He did not soften them for comfort. He told the truth. I had known for some time before the conservatory, he said. I simply refused to admit it. Because of who I am. No, he said, without hesitation. Because of who I am not. He paused, selected the words. I am not accustomed to permitting myself what I want. It seemed simpler to call it duty. She looked at him for a long moment. It is not simpler, she said quietly. No, he agreed. It is considerably more complicated and considerably more painful and achieves nothing. A pause. I do not recommend it. She laughed, briefly, genuinely, with the unguarded quality of a laugh that surprises its owner. He watched her laugh with an expression that he made no effort to compose. She reached across the small distance between them and took his hand. He turned his palm upward and closed his fingers around hers, and they sat like that as the carriage moved through the winter streets, the city giving way to countryside, the lights thinning, the darkness growing softer and more complete. She thought about everything she had believed 4 months ago, when she arrived at Greystone Court with her three good dresses and her father's Bible, and the small leather journal in which she had written, privately and honestly, about a man's smile. She had written about being seen. She had thought, then, that being seen meant being chosen by someone brilliant and warm and careless with his brightness. She had not understood, then, what being truly seen required. Not a glance from across a room, not a charming compliment, not a flower left on a work basket. It required someone who paid attention, not because it cost them nothing, but because they could not stop. Someone who protected, not because it was expected, but because something in them would not permit otherwise. Someone who stood in a gatehouse, in a storm with cold hands, saying her name and meaning every syllable. She understood now. The carriage rolled on. Outside, England passed in the dark. The frozen fields and bare trees, and the first pale suggestion of Greystone Court on the horizon, stone and light, and the Kensington history going back 300 years. She was going to be part of that history. She was going to be the woman who became Duchess, not by scheming or performance or strategic maneuvering, but by being precisely and entirely herself, in all the awkward, honest, insufficient glory of a woman without fortune who loved genuinely and grieved plainly and sat at the edges of ballrooms rather than pretending she belonged in the center. Until someone made it clear that she did. Greystone Court appeared at the end of the drive, candlelit and solid against the winter sky, and Scarlett looked at it, the way she had never quite allowed herself to look at it before, as something that was, or would be, hers. Not inherited, not borrowed, not contingent on the goodwill of people who found her presence useful. Hers. Augustus helped her from the carriage. His hand was warm around hers. She stopped on the stone steps and looked up at him, at the grey eyes that had watched her for 4 months, from careful distances, and were now, finally, not careful at all. I am glad it was you, she said, in the conservatory. Kiawaf. Expression did that opening thing again, quiet and permanent and entirely for her. So am I, he said. He brought her hand to his lips once more, and they went inside together, out of the cold and the dark, into the light of Greystone Court, into the life that was, at last, beginning in earnest. And that is the story of Scarlett Holloway, the girl they threw away, and the Duke who chose her before all of London. If this story moved you, please like this video, subscribe to this channel, and share it with someone who loves a good romance. Drop a comment telling me where you are watching from, and don't forget to leave a hype on this video. It truly means everything. I will see you in the next one.